Welcome to the Tate Talks podcast.
This podcast has been very kindly sponsored by Jump Cloud for MSPs.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Tate Talks. We've got another great episode today with Darren Strong, the Managing Director of Scalable MSP. We spoke about his background within martial arts, his background within MSPs, what they're up to now at Scalable, and some general MSP tips. So really hope you enjoy. But if you do, please remember to subscribe so you won't miss any future episode. Cheers. Hi, Darren. Thanks so much for joining us today on Tate Talks. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, it's no problem. No problem at all. I'm looking forward to hearing more about what you're up to now and a bit about your background. But before we get going, tell us, the listeners, a little bit about yourself, maybe stuff that people may not know that even know you.
Yeah, well, people that will know me, I've been in the MSP world for about 25 years now, helped grow a couple of MSPs. During that time, I've been quite a big chunk in the ConnectWise Evolve world, so what used to be called HTG, and that's sort of where I've done a lot of my learning and a lot of the pain points, really, that I now take forward. I suppose maybe something that people don't know, I'm very big in martial arts for quite a good number of years, so for about 20-ish years, I did martial arts, so got a fourth dan in karate and a first dan in jiu-jitsu. And I quite use a lot of that structure actually in the business now. And, you know, sort of when you've done martial arts for so long, it is quite a big structure that you sort of can't get rid of.
Okay, that's interesting. No, I certainly didn't know that about the martial arts. So that's good to know. And I'll try and remember that if I see you in person. So you say it kind of the structure that martial arts gives sort of helps you within your business life then?
Yeah, definitely. I think what I see, which was born out of the consultancy business, was that a lot of people really struggle to execute. So they struggle to create a structure in their day that isn't just firefighting. And so that structure and that mentality of training and keeping consistent and doing things repetitively in the same way, I think, is something that I've took across into the business world.
Yeah, and that execution is something that we've spoken about quite a lot on this podcast, actually, about creating a plan and then actually executing on that plan. The problem is, I think, as you mentioned, the day-to-day gets in the way, certainly with some of the MSPs that are kind of owner managers that are still very hands-on. It's quite difficult to sort of take that time away from firefighting.
Yeah, and I think if truth be known, I've seen this especially in a lot of junior technical leaders, because during the peer group I facilitated the service exec peer groups, which is basically the technical managers. During that time, what I tend to find is that people have been put in that role because they are the obvious person for that role. They've been there the longest, or they're the most technical, or, you know, they're seen as more senior in the business. But actually, they've not lost the spark for technical. So even though they say they want to be a manager and they say they want to do, let's say, 80-90% of their day as managerial, actually they really like the technical. And I think that's the same when you get a lot of technical owners. So when they've come through the ranks as a technical person, really deep down they want to be technical, and they find that element very easy as well. So when it's something sat in front of you, your human nature is to pick the easiest route out. So if you've got something that you either enjoy, or you find it easier to problem solve, or you've got a finance report that you may not understand as well and you struggle to do certain things, you're going to pick the easy route out, which is go back into the operations and start firefighting. And that's what I see a lot in the industry, is a lot of people are actually doing that day-to-day firefighting because that's the easy route.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually. It brings me on completely off script to a different question around that topic, which is, in your experience, obviously you've worked with lots of sort of service managers and teams. I mean, and you mentioned promotion. There's always, even back in the day when I was running the MSP, there was a kind of, the system was maybe the best engineer ultimately became the kind of service desk manager or something, or the engineering manager, whatever the particular role. Does that work generally, or do you think is it a different mindset, kind of a service management role, or is that naturally suited to an engineer? I mean, how have you seen that work? Is it more of a customer service role or a team leader role?
I actually think it can work, and I might be a bit biased there because that's where I came. I was an engineer and I worked my way up. But I think like I just said, you've got to come to the point where actually those shiny lights or the Premier Inn hotel that you're going to be in every night has sort of become not the shiny thing, and you want another task and another thing to propel you on. I think the other thing that we see a lot about as well is what, without us knowing it as leaders of the business, we do a lot of what I call dump and run. So we bring on a new technical manager, and the day after, he's now the technical manager because he's done this all his life and he knows exactly what he's doing, and I'm just going to walk away. And unfortunately, that's not how it works. You need someone around you that's going to be a mentor. I was fortunate to have that in my first MSP. I was there 15 years, and the gentleman was very much people focused. So I got that mentoring and that structure, and giving you pieces of the segment at the right time rather than just giving you all of it. And then in 6 months' time, you're burnt out and you decide to even leave the business, because unfortunately, a lot of the time you don't want to step down into the same business because you've been that manager.
Yeah, and I think we've probably got similar backgrounds then, because I was a technical background within an MSP and then moved into services management and then into sort of CTO and things in the MSP. And I think you're right. I think it did change. I guess I was quite comfortable and quite the way you described it, I was quite happy to get off the tools, so to speak, in terms of things were changing pretty quickly and it became quite, the role evolved. So that was my route through. So I guess this is a good time to sort of find a little bit more about your career and how you kind of first got into that first MSP.
Yes, I went from a corporate world, and fortunately, unfortunately, in that corporate world, they did a very big migration where I was tagged in with the consulting team. So I got opened up to all the environment, learned a hell of a lot, got a lot of exposure. But then, unfortunately, when that project ended, I got put back into the seat that I was, back into a pigeon hole, and my restrictions were removed. Sorry, applied back onto me. So I then took the decision that actually I've learned a lot of all this stuff, and where can I go and really excel with that? And it just so happened I came across my first MSP, which was a 6 user business, and I stayed with them for 15 years to sort of 50 to 60 people on average. But that was a massive change because I went from a probably 250 people internal IT team to a 6-man business that was supporting external customers.
Yeah, and it's a path well trodden. But I guess at that point that you did that, I mean, MSP, it was an MSP as we describe it now, but I guess back then they were, I mean, the MSP method and systems were probably quite not even around then, or very, very immature.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, I mean, I remember some of our customers had really poor internet lines. Some of them had satellite lines, and we used to go and download the patches onto a DVD at home at night time and go and patch the servers the day after with the CDs. So yeah, it was very much. We did do quite a few services where they were like they are now, where they're all unlimited. So I think we was quite early to that game, but there was still a lot of break fix around, and lots of immature structure really compared to what we have now.
Yeah, and how did you find the transition working from sort of a small piece of a enterprise IT role to an MSP, which are predominantly dealing with sort of small to medium businesses? I mean, were they at that point using the same technology as enterprises were, or were they using kind of scaled down versions of tools?
I would say the technology went down a little bit, but not as much as you would probably think it would. In my experience, what I tend to find is that the bigger the network, the bigger the business, the worse it is. There's actually less structure because there's so many moving parts. But what I really liked is the fact that you was almost like king of the castle. You went on a network, you had everything to your fingertips. And the bit that used to focus really frustrate me, really, and focus me was, you had an issue that you had to escalate to 10 different teams and wait 6 months for that to come back. Where in the world we moved to, the MSP world, you had all the keys to the castle and you could fix and get on with it in effect.
Okay. No, yeah, that's kind of reminiscing. I'm thinking about like what it's like when I was in the early days. It has changed a lot. Certainly, probably mainly on the security side. I think we probably would deploy a piece of antivirus software and a firewall and think that that was pretty much all we needed to do on the security side. And it's a whole
Definitely.
different game now. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We the total it's totally changed, hasn't it? The story. It used to be that, like you say, antivirus, good firewall, then you're secure. Now you've probably got 10 different layers, and we're still saying it still will happen. It's just a when.
Yep. So, talk us through sort of what happened next then, sort of career-wise. How did you evolve through the MSP or world?
Yeah, so the MSP world, I grew with that business. We went through some good times and some bad times. Now, looking back, those bad times and high times were actually the best learning times. And then I was fortunate that that owner took me to the peer groups. So I was very early doors into the HTG, which is now called Evolve Peer Group. And I was the only person in that group that wasn't an owner. And so I then spent 6 to 8 years in rooms every quarter, 3 days a quarter with owners. Discussing strategy, finance, working out how business finance worked, how leading teams worked, and really having a big input there and big learning curve. Then off the back of that, I went on to a couple of more MSPs, one being the MD there, and then really just born out of complete demand from some of the Evolve community. People wanted me to help them with their businesses and very much on the fact that we'd all been in the same rooms, we'd all had the same information, and we all really knew what we should be doing. But could you actually take it back and execute on it, communicate it well, and structure it well rather than firefighting? So people were then linching onto the fact that that was one of my key skills that I did in the MSPs while I'd been around them. So they then brought me into their businesses to help them mature them using those tools. And creating that reoccurring service delivery that we all look for that creates that profitability, happy customers, and more customers without just increasing your manpower, which is what we went through in my first MSP. We just kept increasing manpower the bigger and bigger we went, and actually you're just creating a bigger and bigger headache and lots more people to feed.
Yeah, and we'll come to your sort of new business shortly, but I just wanted to touch a little bit on peer groups, and regular listeners will know that I'm always talking about peer groups and how great I think they are. But HTG, as was at that point when I was the story I'm going to mention, Evolve now with ConnectWise, is I was at a peer when I was at Datto, we're sponsoring the peer groups, and we got to do this thing. I think they call it seat at the table or something, which is a little session before lunch. The sponsor can go in and sort of sit and observe this peer group in action. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was in Brighton, and I forget which group it was. But I was absolutely blown away by the openness of this of the group, the way that they were talking to each other, interacting. Some of the stuff wasn't even around the business. It was kind of around the sort of personal life, personal goals, exit, ambitions, everything. And it was the, which is why I always generally refer to them more as accountability groups, because a peer group is obviously a group that talks about things, but I look at the groups like Evolve as more accountability groups, because if you say you're going to do something and then you've not done it by the next meeting, they're going to mention that, and that's going to be brought back up to you, which obviously drives this engagement. So yeah, I was a huge fan of the HTG and Evolve and all the different groups around it. I think for MSPs that are serious about growing, I think they're a really, really good resource.
Yeah, and I definitely think that you see a big difference in maturity and financial structure and also where do they want to go? Quite often we're built into the daily life, we're firefighting, and we're not actually, yes, we want to build a business today. Maybe you've even got a revenue number, but there's no structure in how we're getting there. What does that mean? How are we going to go there? What steps are we going to take? What different structures are we going to need in that pathway? And I think that's what the Evolve and other peer groups as well that I've been involved in, I'm still involved in now. That's what they bring. You can see the difference between MSPs that are being run where they are in communication with other MSPs, and you're getting all that 360 feedback, you're getting all that 360, even research and development. What products should we be using? Why should we be using those products versus somebody that's going it alone? If you're going it alone, you've only got your own muscle and feel, gut and feel of how you're going to run the business, where if you've got another 20, 30, 40 people around you that have either been there and done it or they're going through it with you, there's a lot more heads, isn't there? There's a lot more knowledge in the room.
Absolutely. And this is not a peer group plug, but an additional benefit, which I'm guessing you're seeing at Scalable, which we'll talk about in a second, is around sort of the acquisition. It's kind of a big topic at the minute. It's MSPs are being acquired all of the time and acquiring. But I know several sort of private equity firms and things that are, when they're looking to acquire companies, they're actively looking for people that are part of a peer group because they can, they know that they're a well-run organization, which is obviously what people acquiring MSPs are looking for.
Yeah, definitely. And also the business owner, because of that peer group structure that is typically in the peer groups that I'm involved in, what they're trying to get used to do all the time is to not work in the business, but work on the business. That then means that the more mature you get at doing that, and you become even just the strategic element to the business and maybe mentoring to the business, well, when you then step away from the business, that business is still operational and continue going as though you were there. So from a buyer's point of view, that is a lot less risk, and there's a lot more value there because they know that that business is well structured and it's repeatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, as I say, the buyers are looking for that. And I think that's, if anyone is looking to sort of plan their exit for their MSP, that's something certainly to consider. So what are you up to now then? What's the story with Scalable MSP?
Yeah, so Scalable MSP, like I said a minute ago, was born out of just demand. So people asking me, can I help them to put in certain structures that they may even know, but they just don't know how to go about it, or they haven't got the time. And we've very much built it on the ConnectWise ecosystem and the tools that we've learned around the peer groups, so things around service leadership, etc. And what we're trying to do is put in the best practices without overriding what you're about. So I believe there's lots of MSPs, and there's the reason for that. We all do it slightly differently. We all have different, slightly different customers and different demands. And what we're talking about there really is your USPs. So what we're trying to do is mature your business whilst keeping those USPs. So we're not just delivering one framework that you see from a common consulting point of view. And then also the other big thing that we talked a little bit about there around execution is, rather than we teach you how to set up your systems and your structure and your processes, etc., what we're going to do is work out what that framework needs to look like, and then we're going to implement it for you. So we do what we call heavy lifting, where we will actually do all the configurations and documentation and reporting to match the framework that we've agreed. So it means that the piece around execution and integration, the actual MSP doesn't have to be involved with.
And what parts of the MSP's business do you touch there? I know you're obviously from a service background, but do you touch upon the other parts of the MSP as well?
Yep, yeah, all from top to bottom, really. So we start with the end in mind. So what's the business going to be run on? So what financial data and KPIs at the top level? That then flows all the way down to the individual, whether you're in operations, sales, finance, back office. And then we're structuring the whole system around that. So then ultimately, you're going to get the data to run the business on. And big believer as well that individuals need to know what success look like for them. So that the top level KPIs come all the way down to the individual, and we present reporting and dashboards to them so they know exactly where they are at any minute of the day.
Yeah, that's again another topic which has been mentioned before on this podcast. It's not only setting the targets and sorry, the objectives and the goals or whatever we want to call them, but make sure that everyone's on board rather than just setting them at the top level and then no one else knows what they're working towards. So I think that'll be super useful for MSPs. So what I'll do is I'll drop all of your contact details, LinkedIn and website and things below. So if any MSPs are interested in chatting, I'm sure you'd be up for that, knowing you like to talk about MSP stuff as much as I do. So I'm sure people will take you up on that.
Yeah, more than happy to help, even if it's just a conversation over a pain point that they've got. We see a lot of MSPs now, so we see lots of different ways of achieving different things and different outcomes. Everyone's success criteria is always slightly different, and that's one of the things that I learned in the peer groups. What is the end point in mind? Some people want just the business to have been successful and give careers for people, and other people need to have a value at the end.
Yeah, and you've just touched upon the next question, really, because I was going to ask you. Obviously, you're speaking to MSPs all the time, and in different states, different sort of maturity stages, different sizes, all kinds of different things. So, what are you seeing? What are the big challenges that MSPs are facing as we get towards the sort of back end of 2023 and into 24?
I would say, you know, it's a big topic. It's been around a few years. It's security, isn't it? You know, it's not just, now what's coming to mind is that it's not just the security of your clients. It's actually you. You are the biggest target. So what security and structure and strategies and compliance levels do you need as an MSP? You know, you're a big target. So what are you going to do about that? And how are you going to educate your team? And then I think the second thing is then around your people. So how do you nurture, mentor, and keep and attract your team? There's a very big shortage now of people that actually know you know, what they're doing in the MSP world, and they're good people. And so how do you attract those people, but also how do you keep the people that you've got as you're growing?
Again, it's sounding like a greatest hits of tips on this, so, which is good. Everyone's aligned. But yeah, that's a topic which is fascinating. And I don't know how we're going to resolve it. I mean, security is definitely an issue and it's definitely there. But I think the recruitment and sort of retention of staff is something which is a big problem for MSPs. And I know that, you know, there are different things that people can do around trying to automate more. And I guess AI can start to play a role in different things going forward. But it's such a competitive market in the whole ecosystem, from the that talented, if you get some skilled engineers on board and you don't look after them properly, then there's a lot of people that will try and sort of tempt them out away from their organization.
And I think also it's been going on for a number of years that unfortunately lots of MSPs haven't been very good at nurturing their own blood. So they've not been very good at bringing juniors, apprentices, and bring them up through the ranks. And so everybody's fighting for the tier two, tier threes. You know, nobody's fighting for the tier ones and apprentices, but nobody wants them. So how do you create structure in your business, pathways, compliance levels, even ticket cycles and flows, that it means that actually you can have an apprentice and they can deliver just as much value as someone that's been with you 4 years, because the structure's there. And then that's going to help them to move through those ranks without increasing the risk to you or your clients. And I think there's a lot of MSPs just don't do enough of that.
And that's bottom line affecting stuff, right? Because if you can get sort of tier one engineers to resolving more and more tickets, then that effectively ultimately means you can take on more clients without massively increasing the number of staff all the time, which is obviously what you mentioned has happened before. And that can sort of make the MSP sort of operate really efficiently and profitably.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, we all see it. You know, client A rings up and asks for Bob. And every time they ring, they ask for Bob. And Bob's a senior engineer that's been there 20 years. But they're only asking for Bob because actually they get the same journey, the fastest journey, and they get a resolution first time. And so if you can provide that on the phone with a junior engineer, that's then scalable at very little cost, rather than having all your engineers being 20 years. Because the only reason why they're asking for them is because every time they ring up is they get a different journey, they get a different answer, and they don't get the right outcome.
Yeah, a first-hand experience of that with a Bob in the organization. It's the it's Bob's knowledge, I guess, and that, I suppose that's where platforms come in that can help in terms of documentation and previous ticket history, and to ensure that the sort of any engineer is kind of able to get access to Bob's knowledge on that particular client, rather than having to speak to Bob every time.
Yeah, and also the maturity of the sales teams and the owners. You know, how do we sell and deliver the same service to every customer under the same technology stack? And what we tend to do, especially when we've got principal-led selling or owner-led selling, that owner's got all the levers and all the strings that he can pull, and then you end up with 50 customers that have all got something slightly differently, and only the people that have been with you a long time actually know what we deliver for those customers and how we deliver it. Where if you had 50 customers with the same technology stack, the same service, the same structure, that becomes very easy then to structure.
Yeah, absolutely. And that the sort of way that that's packaged is vital. And I think principal-led sales or whatever, that's something that a lot of MSPs are still going through. I think I think a lot of them now are kind of are probably recruiting sort of salespeople and sales managers and whatever. But ultimately, in the MSP world, which is kind of owner managed by technical people, that they started the business, they're probably still the face of the business and trying to do a lot of the sales, which is again from an exit point of view, is probably something that they shouldn't be doing or trying to step down from a little.
Yeah, and typically what, you know, most MSPs in the UK are sort of 1.5-2 million or less. And so if you look at the best practice financial structure from service leadership, well, your SG&A, your service and general admin should be 30% of your business. Well, you then don't have a lot of money left out of that 30% to actually get good sales teams. So you've got to get your revenue to a certain amount with your profitability at best in class before you can even start to look at structuring a sales team, because actually there isn't money to fund a sales team. So that's why I think you see a lot of principal led selling.
Yeah. And it is challenging, I think, again, it's twofold. It's the principal led, and it's also, because they're technical, I think recruiting salespeople is difficult when it's a technical person doing the recruiting, and then understanding how to let them get on and do their job.
And managing them as well and setting them up for success. Your first salesperson is always your hardest when you're doing principal-led selling, especially if there's not a lot of structure there around what you sell. Well, then there's no service catalog, there's no marketing material, there's no sales material, there's no structure about what we do and how we do it and what we don't do, how we sell it, what prices we sell it at. And so if you can bring a very good salesperson in, you still can't allow them to be successful because you can't actually give them any materials and any structure to be successful. So before you do that, the first thing you need to do is to build that structure and build what does success look like and your service catalogs and all your calculators to allow them to even have the ability to sell.
Yeah, and I guess this all comes back to what we were saying before around sort of peer groups and working with organisations like yourselves, because you can sort of help put that in place for people, which is quite difficult to do on your own. Especially, as you say, if you're working in the business 24/7, you've not got time to take that step back and sort of work on the business, which is what's necessary.
Yeah, you know, most people are working 60, 70 hours a week already, so where are you going to achieve that extra time?
Mm-hmm. Well, talking of work, when you're not working with your downtime, I mean, what do you do? Are you one of these sort of business book readers that's always looking at the latest business books? Do you listen to podcasts, or are you more of a kind of fiction, Netflix kind of person? What do you do when you're not working?
During a lot of my career, I've seen a lot of things fail and succeed. And I think one of those comes back down to how do you create your work-life balance? You've got to have a work-life balance. So you've got to have an element of your work, of your time, that isn't work. You know, if you see that your relaxation is reading a business book, well, that's not switched off from work. So I'm quite a big gym goer, quite a big fitness person like that. Again, I think it comes from the martial arts side. So that's the time when I'm not in front of something that's got technology attached to it. I've not got my phone with me or my computer, etc. And you're just focused on the gym. But then that being said, I do quite a lot of traveling. So the traveling is where I then fill that using Audible books and podcasts. So that's where I typically do a lot of my podcasts and Audibles. I tend to find, especially when I'm driving, I don't really listen to music. So music is on in the background, but I couldn't tell you what's played. Where if I listen to an Audible book or a podcast, I can tell you exactly what people have been saying. So I use a lot of travel time to do the education piece, but then make sure that I've got a good chunk of time that is actually downtime.
Yeah, I mean, I don't read enough books, definitely don't, but I'm trying to. I can't, if I listen to a book in the car on Audible, it's sort of, for me personally, it's in one ear and out the other. I don't know if I'm concentrating on the driving or whatever. So if I'm walking or on a train, I can listen to an audio book, but the car, I'm absolutely useless at doing that. So I try just to listen to the radio and let it sort of go in one ear and out the other. But it's interesting how people are sort of different in that and approach. And I do get your point that, you know, if your downtime is reading a book about MSPs, then that's probably not really downtime. You're still working, which is, it's not good to be working 24/7 for anyone.
Yeah, you know, and Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of business owners that I've seen that unfortunately have had divorces and or missed a big chunk of their family time, their children growing up. And I'm not perfect by any means. I've missed some chunk of that as well that I wish I hadn't. But I think you've got to have a good focus not to do that and make sure you do have that downtime. In one of the pay groups I've been in, they used to have a questionnaire. Sorry, they still have a questionnaire that you send to your spouse. And one of those questions is, how much do you use your mobile phone at the dinner table? And they score you 1 to 10. And they're interesting conversations. You know, why is it that you use your phone at the table? Why are you trying to catch up on work? Or why are you trying to look at social media when you should be interacting with the family?
Yeah, and I've written before on the blog around email on phones and things. I go in phases, but at the minute I've taken my business email off my phone now and Slack, so I don't have access to that. If I need email, I go to the laptop and stuff, because if someone really wants to get hold of me, then they can text or WhatsApp or whatever. There's ways of communicating, whereas email, it's especially again, you work with lots of sort of international companies. I work for an international company. You kind of get emails coming in at all times of day or night, which the person that's sending it isn't expecting an instant response, because they, but if you're sat in bed at night at 11 o'clock and you get the email, you do feel kind of obliged to reply to it. So I kind of thought the best way to deal with this is just to take it off my phone, and I feel a lot better for it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those individuals that I can't see the number one on the icon. So I've got it on my phone and there's a number one. I've got to have gone in and read it. And then once I've read it, I've got to act on it. So I did some structure on my phone quite a long time ago about moving all the icons to a different folder, turning off all the numbers. So I've got to be, my intent has got to be there to go looking to see that. So all my emails and my social media, etc., are in separate folders, and it's got to be my intent to go looking rather than them disturbing me.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to do it. Maybe something I need to consider, because see, I'm the same. If I've got a kind of an unread email, I probably wouldn't be able to get to sleep. I'd even try and get to sleep, and then I think I've got, what was that email? So I'd go and have to check it out, and that's not good. An email isn't designed for this sort of direct conversation, two-way synchronous conversation. But we kind of treat it like that. We almost treat email now more like a WhatsApp or a
Yeah,
Slack
like
or
a
something.
chat.
People have tried straight away, and I don't think it's really designed for that. So it's not good.
Yeah. Well, quite a lot of our shopping structure now is like that, isn't it? So you look at the Amazons of the world, that's what we've created. And we see that in the MSP world. A client now buys a PC. We could have delivered that in 3, 4 weeks, 5, 6 years ago. Now they want it tomorrow because that's the type of thing that they get from when they do online shopping. And that's the same thing with email and social media, isn't it? We expect an instant response now.
Yeah, I know, it's not healthy for sure, and I'm sure it's gonna, hopefully over time it's going to change and we can start to move away from email. But I've been saying email's dying for the last 10 years and it's still there, so I don't know whether it's ever going to happen or not. It just seems to be more and more of it. When I was predicting there'll be less and less of it, but it shows what I know.
I think what we are seeing now is that there's too many channels. So in typical worlds, you've got Teams, you've got WhatsApp, you've got email, and you may communicate with this one person on all three of those channels. And it's actually keeping up. Which one of those channels did you say what, and what do you need to reply to, and what's on your action list? I think that's one of the problems now, is actually how do you keep a track of it all?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I often think, oh, I've had a message from this person. I know I've had a message, and then I have to kind of go hunting. Was it in LinkedIn? Was it in WhatsApp? Was it in Slack? Was it on email? And you kind of spend half an hour trying to track down where the message came in, which is, yeah, you've got all these different communication methods for the same people. It's all very confusing. Cool. Right. Well, we're at the last question, because we're at time, or a little over actually. So, again, speaking to MSPs, have you got kind of a sort of tip or a little bit of advice that you would give them to help them with their business?
I think the biggest thing that we see repeated across a lot of our partners is a service catalogue. So a service catalogue contains what do you sell in what type of packages, and what do you do inside those packages, and then more importantly, what do you not do? So you then create a service structure that tells all your teams, your technical teams, sales team, marketing teams, finance teams, what do we expect from this service? Even, does it have to be on direct debit? Do we have to do credit checks, etc.? Having that service catalog creates so much clarity in your MSP. And when we typically find a lot of issues inside an MSP, when you peel back the onion, it actually comes back down to the service catalog isn't written down. It's all hearsay, and everybody's got a different viewpoint on what actually is your core IT support, for instance. So I think my biggest tip would be to actually spend some time in a group of people from your team, not just yourself. So get different people from different departments to actually come together and agree what is the core services that you deliver.
Yeah, and I think that what historically may have put people off from that is I think people, certainly back in the day, were probably a little bit frightened by a service catalog, thinking it was part of ITIL and this sort of huge monster that you'd have to deploy, when it's not the case, I guess. What you're saying is that anything's better than nothing, and you could start small and create, just get something in process.
If you don't have anything and you create just a one-page document for every service, that's going to be way better than what you've got now. And then every question you get or issue that you get that might be a niggle for a customer because somebody reacted differently or the customer asked for something and you said no, creating that and just adding to that and just make it a living, breathing document means that the questions will become less and the customer clarity will get better and their journey will get better because they'll see the same journey every time they ask for the same thing because everybody will be following that Bible.
Yeah, perfect. And that's what everyone's striving for, which is the consistency. So that's a great tip. So thanks again for joining us, Darren. I will put all your details, as I mentioned, below into the comments, and hopefully we can talk again soon. But I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and hopefully it's been useful for your listeners.
And that's that. Another episode completed. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for Darren for taking part. And hopefully, we'll see you soon on Tate Talks. Goodbye.
This podcast has been very kindly sponsored by Jump Cloud for MSPs. Jump Cloud for MSPs provides managed service providers a platform for delivering modern IT services that are identity-centric, cloud-native, and vendor-agnostic. Using Jump Cloud's Open Directory platform, MSPs can iteratively replace point solutions by unifying device, identity, and access management. To learn more, please visit jumpcloud.com/MSP or email the team at partners@jumpcloud.com.